Are you ready? It's time for On the Double with the Double S Express. Great sports talk and big-time guests with Sean Wally and Sean Boyd. On the Double with the Double S Express.
What's going on, everybody? Sean Wally alongside Sean Boyd, the Double S Express here for show 26. Sean Boyd, what's happening?
Hey, what's happening, Sean Wally? Man, a great festive weekend this past weekend in sports, man.
So much going on. Not enough time to get to all of it, of course. And tell us what went down for you working for Fox Sports yesterday.
Oh, man. Well, I can tell you what definitely went down, and that's the spirits and the hopes of the Raiders fans, the Raider Nation, man. It was, it started out just a lovely day. I mean, the clear skies, 62 degrees at kickoff. You know, I'm driving down the 80 corridor, and I'm thinking, man, this is going to be something special. First chance for the Oakland Raiders in a long time at this point to put themselves, vault themselves back into existence with a 4-4 record at the halfway point of the NFL season. And I'm thinking, man, this is, you know, no better way to come in and have a team like the Philadelphia Eagles come in, who haven't shown that they've played their best football as of yet. Of course, we had talked a few weeks ago as far as Chip Kelly's offense and, you know, all the great things that come with it. But, you know, there was that, I guess in the back of my mind, there was that fear that, you know, the Philadelphia Eagles could put one together. But I didn't think that it would be on this day. And, you know, getting a chance to see some of our past guests at the game. We've had David Massey coming all the way down from Portland, Oregon, to the Oakland Raiders game. Diehard Raiders fan, very excited. Of course, Darryl Brown, famous MLB scout. He was at the game, and we had a chance to converse and talk and hang out. And, you know, it felt like it was going to be one of those days. I even had a chance to see one of my old high school classmates and, you know, from Tacoma, Washington. And it just – everything just seemed right, Sean Wally. And then the kickoff happened.
Yeah, man, that's great that you were able to spend some time with, you know, friends and past guests on the show and get a chance to shake hands and – get some pictures with everybody and just thank them for hopping on, helping us out, and giving their expertise.
Yeah, you know, the feeling in O.co was that it was, you know, something special was about to happen. And, you know, it was an excitement that hasn't been there for a while. And you could tell that, you know, there was a feeling that, you know, we're about to turn the corner. And, you know, you got to give it to Nick Foles. As the, you know, the quarterback for the Philadelphia Eagles, he put on an exhibition. And, you know, I don't want to take anything away from Nick Foles, because I believe that he's a great quarterback. I believe that he's going to do some excellent things in the NFL, which, you know, I just don't think that, you know, you can hang your hat on it just yet that he is going to take over this job, or he took the job from Michael Vick. But you have to look at that Raiders defense, you know, and here they are. They're coming in this week as one of the top 10 defenses in the NFL this year, not giving up a 20-plus run to an opponent this year. And things just look great. You know, you have this, you know, this defensive back core that's, you know, up and coming, and then you have some veterans. We just didn't see it coming, Sean Wally. And, you know, I believe that maybe, just maybe, the Oakland Raiders started to buy into a little bit of their press clippings, because they just came out flat-footed and the whole stadium was in shock.
What do you think the reason was that the Raiders basically came out flat from what I could see from afar? Now you've also got more injuries that are creeping back up, and, you know, the Raiders were trying to, you know, ride a wave and things were going okay, and then yesterday just kind of all came crashing down.
Yeah, you know, I would say that it's immaturity on a team that's trying to gel and come together. And as I had mentioned before, you know, the feeling in at O.co was a feeling that hasn't been felt in a while. There was a confidence level in the fans. There was a confidence level in the Raider players. And I just don't think that they knew how to adapt to that. And there's a way that you can – there's a saying that we have as coaches that we coach our players to. We call it keeping – you know, being even keel, staying even keel. And, you know, I could tell that Oakland, when they came out yesterday, they weren't even keel. I think that they were so emotionally high that, you know, this was a big game that was going to put them at another level and or taking a step and being a good team, that they just couldn't handle it. It was overwhelming.
And let's move up the I-5 freeway to the Pacific Northwest and go out to the phone lines and welcome in big-time guest number one tonight, Art Thiel of Sports Press Northwest, longtime Seattle sports columnist. Art, thanks so much for your time tonight.
Gentlemen, it's a pleasure.
Hey, Art. Thanks for being on the show, man.
Sure.
Well, let's get right into it. I mean, you know, there's some great things that you're doing. As Sean Wally just mentioned, Sports Press Northwest. Tell our listeners how that came about.
Well, I've been a sports writer in the market here in Seattle for a long time. And when my paper went out of business, I decided to not let that stop me. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer had been around for 150 years, but the owners, the Hearst Corporation in New York, decided no mas. So I worked for them for a while after the closing for their online remnant, and I decided that I would join forces with my co-founder, Steve Rudman, and we created a website covering the Seattle sports scene, University of Washington, Washington State University, as well as the Seahawks, Mariners, and Sounders. And we launched in December of 2010. We've had about 4 million unique visitors, and our traffic's up 90% from over a year ago. And the idea here is to try to keep alive the notion that quality journalism, quality sports journalism, can still prevail in a time when other kinds of journalism, like aggregating and people not doing original work, were starting to dominate the sports media scene. So, you know, it's always, when you're starting up your own business, it's always a struggle and an effort, but it is happening now. So we really are excited for the future prospects, and we've been credentialed by all the major media sites, and now we're going and looking for... We have other partnerships with King 5 News here, the NBC affiliate. Crosscut.com is a news outlet, and I'm also on KPLU-FM and CBS Radio here in Seattle. So multiple platforms and multiple gigs are happening for entrepreneurship here, and I'm really enjoying it.
It sounds like, Art, that you know, definitely put your best foot forward as far as after the Seattle Post-Intelligencer went to non-existence. You know, step by step, you're mentioning KPLU and a couple of other ventures. Was there ever a point in time where you felt like, man, is this not going to happen for me, and what am I doing here?
Well, you know, it's always difficult when you're starting up something. Excuse me. I've been... you know, to me, the idea of being an independent journalist has always been enticing, because so many of my colleagues are winding up working for, excuse me, for the leagues and the conferences, and I felt that isn't the best, honest way to deal with the sports public, because the idea here is to maintain independence from the sports teams and not necessarily be beholden to MLB or NFL.com or NBA.com, because I think there's a lot of room in the sports marketplace for honest and hopefully insightful and sometimes humorous information that doesn't have to be approved by the sports leagues or the teams or the conferences. So I think there's a niche, and I think the consumers are responding.
That's the voice of Art Thiel of SportsPressNorthwest.com, longtime sports columnist in Seattle for the Seattle PI. Art, what are some of your fondest memories of your years covering all these various Seattle teams, players, coaches? What are some that stick out to you and just are some of your best memories of the work you've done?
Well, I think, there's been certainly peaks with the successes that Seattle teams have had, even though that comes few and far between. In terms of a long-running intensity and very compelling theater, the Mariners run in 1995, when they came from 13 down behind the Angels to win their first American League West pennant, was a lot of fun because there were some real characters in that team. Ken Griffey Jr., Jay Buhner, Lou Piniella was the manager. Lots of fun, lots of excitement, and just, unpredictable stuff. That was certainly a highlight. And then I think the Seahawks run to the Super Bowl in 2005 was another highlight. The Sonics getting to the NBA Finals in 1996, another big deal. And I just was writing about recently another highlight moment back in the middle 80s when Don James was coach at the University of Washington. The Huskies made the Orange Bowl against Oklahoma. And they played on January 1st, 1985, the famous Sooner Schooner game, in which the Huskies upset the then number one ranked Oklahoma Sooners 28-17, in part due to the fact that after a touchdown, the Sooner Schooner, which is part of the scoring ritual at Oklahoma, came out onto the field a little early and got penalized 15 yards for unsportsmanlike conduct. So those are some of the games that I had the privilege of covering 9 Olympics, and those were really highlights. They're really hard work for a journalist because there's a lot of travel and a lot of, awkwardness with foreign cultures, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. Those Olympic games, they're just a special occasion because, the mixing of the worlds, mixing of the cultures, and you get a chance to see some astounding athletic performances. It's really a treat, and those are the highlights, really, the Olympics and several of the other successes. And I wish there had been a few more successes with the Mariners, but they're on a 10-year losing streak, and there hasn't been a lot of fun there.
Well, I definitely believe, Art, that things are on the horizon. There's a couple of changes that are being made. At least I hope that there are some definite changes on the horizon for the Mariners. Speaking of, you wrote a book in 2003 on the Seattle Mariners called Out of Left Field. And, tell the listeners a little bit about that book. I believe that it had to do with the Lou Piniella era and, some of the things that were going on as far as the Mariners organization turning things around.
Yeah, it was a book about the run-up to then what was one of the more remarkable business successes in baseball. The Seattle Mariners were the slowest team to reach 500 of any major professional sports franchise in the expansion era. It took them 15 years to get to 500, and everyone said it was a lousy baseball town and the Kingdome was ugly and terrible for baseball and had all these strikes against it. And then they managed to string together 6 weeks of great baseball in 1995, which I mentioned earlier, and it had this incredibly transformative effect on the community, because what was at stake was the team itself. There were plans to move that team from originally 1991 to Florida, and local ownership surfaced with a Japanese lead investor. And then in 95, they were almost as good as gone then, because a stadium deal had not was voted down in Seattle. So there were a lot of very dramatic stories going on with the Mariners, from Griffey to Buhner to Edgar Martinez to Piniella to Randy Johnson, coupled with this great political intrigue going on in the city of Seattle about whether they were going to be public, whether Seattle was going to fund publicly a new baseball stadium to replace the Kingdome. And that was a really fascinating story about the politics in the state capital of Olympia, as well as the city hall here in Seattle, and the King County government, And then the Mariners themselves, who had to threaten, cajole, and wheedle to try to get this stadium done, and they finally did it in October of 1995 after they had beaten the Yankees in the American League Division Series. So all of those things came together, and I said, I was approached by a publisher in Seattle about this, and I said, yeah, this is a good idea. I like this. So we put it together, and it was a regional bestseller in 2003, and it was really a hallmark of my career.
Yeah, Art, you know, just talking about that time back in 1995, I remember where I was and, you know, the things that were going on at that time. And I was scratching my head thinking, wow, how in the world could we come to this point as far as, you know, getting ready to lose a team? I mean, you know, you're talking about tiles that are falling out from the roof of the Kingdom. You're talking about a team that's just trying to find themselves. And then this playoff run happens. I believe that they went from worst to first.
They were 13 games out of first place in early August of 95, and they ran down the Angels in that time and won it on the final day of the season.
Yeah, just an amazing time, and it was great for the city of Seattle because it took our minds off of all of the bureaucratic and political things that were going on to keep the team there, but to have something to celebrate and something to cheer for. And you talk about falling on every pitch, you know, especially, you know, at the latter part of the season. And, of course, as you were saying, winning that game against the Angels to get into the playoffs and then that miraculous win against the New York Yankees. You know, I don't know if anybody around the world, you know, you'd have to not have a pulse to not feel the goosebumps as far as Griffey, you know, rounding the bases from first. And, you know, it was just a great time, a miraculous time. And, you know, out of left field, you know, regional bestseller should have been, you know, a world bestseller. I mean, I think I'm on those times, and, you know, it was an excellent, excellent time for the city of Seattle.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun because this was the first time that the Mariners had been involved in a pennant race. There was so much cynicism. The team began in 1977. And it didn't make the playoffs until that year of 1995. And there was a lot of, you know, belief that this wasn't going to work. I mean, the expression at the time was, you know, Seattle is a bad baseball town. And I said, no, you've got it wrong. It's a town of bad baseball. You know, there's a big difference. And the succession of
yeah,
owners.
A huge difference.
Yeah. You know, and I think it's... you know, the owners, the ownerships of the time through the original six guys of local businessmen and entertainer Danny Kaye to George Argyros to Jeff Smullyan never invested in the baseball product. They always kept an eye on the bottom line. The team was always lousy. And there was a, you know, genuine belief that this team was not going to succeed. And I just thought that was totally unfair. I said, why don't you try investing in the ballpark, investing in the team, and see what happens, you know? And they didn't really do that too much in 95, but a lot of things did come together, especially with Pinella and Griffey in tow, to make something happen. And then, you know, like I said, 6 weeks of great baseball got them a stadium. People were so passionate, so excited about the team, following it every day. And then to beat the Yankees, you know, as Lou Piniella said, Edgar Martinez's double that scored the winning run was the hit, the game, the series, and the year that saved baseball in Seattle.
Art Thiel joining us from SportsPressNW.com. Art, one final Mariner question. What are your thoughts on the prospects of who the final members for the managerial position may be? There's rumors that Joey Corris is still in the running, along with Lloyd McClendon and Chip Hale.
Well, I don't know that anybody has any real insight right now. I think they're going to decide this week. But I have to say this, after 10 years of dreariness and losing, I don't think it makes much difference because the Mariners have had more managerial turnover than any franchise in sports over the last 10 years. This will be the sixth manager in 10 years, and clearly the Mariner ownership that doesn't know what it's doing in terms of hiring and firing, and so they're just going to get another, you know, sacrificial guy. I think Chip Hale, from all I've read, sounds like he's ready to become a baseball manager. But frankly, I don't know why he would want to do it here. I understand there's only 30 of these jobs, but this is just kind of a dead end situation for a manager right now, and it's too, you know, it's a shame, because what really needs to happen is a change at the ownership level, but that is not in the immediate offing. So they're going to hire somebody who's destined to get fired in about a year and a half.
Yeah, that product definitely has to improve on the field before anything else happens. And let's switch gears to a game you were at yesterday at CenturyLink up in the press box. And the Seahawks got another victory to move to 8-1, but struggles along the way again, second week in a row. What's your take on that? Is it just a good thing they're finding a way to win, or are there some kinks in this armor?
Yes and yes. they have done a very good job of performing under all sorts of duress because they've had some injuries along the offensive line that has made the offense vulnerable. And then it's been a little struggle on the defense the last couple of weeks to stop the run. So they do have problems, but they do find a way around it. And much of that is attributable to Russell Wilson. He is a quarterback that is well beyond his years and well beyond his height in ability to marshal this team together. He's an extraordinary leader and a great athlete. I mean, he was drafted to play pro baseball as well, so he's really got some extraordinary intangibles as well as very tangible athleticism. So I think what you're seeing here is what is being seen around the NFL, generally speaking. There are a handful, you know, half a dozen good teams, all with some degree of vulnerability right now. And I think the Seahawks' vulnerability is on the offensive line. They're missing both their starting tackles. Once they get back, I think they have a chance to be, and the line has a chance to be average. It'll never be great, but they don't need to be great when they have Russell Wilson at quarterback and Marshawn Lynch in the backfield. So, and they're also going to get Percy Harvin for the first time, probably in a couple of weeks. Harvin was the great wide receiver and kick returner from Minnesota that the Seahawks traded for in March, but he hasn't played it down yet because he had a hip problem that had to be repaired surgically on August 1st. So he is practicing now. He's running. I think he'll need to take a few hits in practice, but after that he'll be returning, and that will fill another void the Seahawks had. Sidney Rice, their wide receiver, was lost for the season with a torn ACL. So they are hobbling on offense, but I also think that Super Bowls aren't won in November. It's usually happens in the first week in February. So if the Seahawks can pull their healthy parts together, they're going to have a real chance to make a big splash in the postseason.
Art Teal, kind enough to join us on the Double with the Double S Express. Art, you had mentioned Sidney Rice going down with the injury, and of course, Percy Harvin coming to step back in. You know, I kind of liken this to the sheepdogs in the Warner Brothers cartoons, where they, you know, one clocks in and the other one clocks out to beat the mess out of the coyote. And so you never really have, you know, both of them on all cylinders. You know, what's the biggest fear right now that you think that Seattle has as far as, you know, the longevity as the season goes on?
Well, I think the biggest worry is that Russell Wilson is going to get pounded into oblivion. He, according to Pro Football Focus, who keeps track of these things, he has had the most duress of any quarterback in the NFL, and that means sacks, quarterback hits, and quarterback hurries. So the line has not protected well. Russell's taken a pounding. This was, even though they didn't sack him in the game Sunday, he got hit hard. In fact, two roughing the passer penalties he drew. And so I think that's the big concern, is that the Seahawks offense won't get healthy enough, fast enough, to save Russell Wilson's hide. And I think he got the cumulative effect was a little bit visible last week. I don't think there's any reason that he'll be kept out of the game in Atlanta this Sunday. But he's taken some fearsome hits, and it just accumulates over time. The NFL is obviously a very tough league, and even as athletic and clever as he is, he's still getting hit a lot. That's the biggest concern.
Yeah, you know, it makes for exciting football, no doubt. But as you were mentioning, you have these sensational quarterbacks that can move out of the pocket and, you know, they can create and make things happen. But as we're starting to see, of course, we saw it with RG3 first last year, you know, with his big injury. And then, of course, in Oakland, you saw Terrell Pryor take a tremendous concussion. And these types of things happen when quarterbacks move out of the pocket. It just seems like it's a matter of time with these mobile quarterbacks, even though it's glamorous and it looks great. You're right, Art. We're talking about, you know, health. We're talking about, you know, a team that has to be strong going towards the end of the season. And Seattle has to figure something out here with the offensive line to protect their quarterback. Otherwise, you know, they could receive a shock just almost as they did yesterday or almost did yesterday.
Yeah, well, it's it really is a hazard right now because, you know, I think that the offensive coordinator has tried to reemphasize the run, and that worked pretty well yesterday. They had 198 yards rushing, 125 by Lynch. There's only so much you can do with a scheme in terms of short drops. You're eventually going to have to expose Russell to some, you know, five and seven step drops, and I think that's where his vulnerability is greatest. So they have to get the old tackles back. They've got a rookie starting at one side and a converted guard at the other side on the left, and it just isn't a healthy thing. The I think Wilson, if he gets the proper protection, is going to do as well as he did in his rookie year last year. And if you remember, the Seahawks had three wins in a row, averaging totaling 150 points, and it was a remarkable feat. There are people who are saying, well, you know, we may have seen the best of Russell in that first year. I'm not ready to buy that yet. This kid's got an unlimited ceiling, but it's only there if he can be healthy and take the snaps.
Yeah, you know, I want to know your opinion on one thing here, Art, and you know, I'm just going to throw this out here, and you can tell me what you think about it. I'm thinking that the more that Seattle finds ways to skin a cat, that it's going to come back to haunt them. And what I mean by that is Seattle has figured out so many ways to come back and win games or save games that it seems like they're showing their card. They don't really have that ace in the hole. And, you know, as the year goes on, teams are going to find out, okay, this is a situation that Seattle handled in this area. We can stop this, or this is what they did in this game, you know, and they're going to find ways to counter it. Do you see that Seattle is looking at that in the near future?
Well, I think there's some of that going on now. I think that what's happened is the Seahawks have had to dumb down their playbook a little bit to compensate for the problem in pass protection. So they are a little bit vanilla right now. On the other hand, I do think that, you know, return to health to just an NFL average line is going to be sufficient because, there are some things that defenses can't do much about, and one of them is Marshawn Lynch. He is just one of the toughest dudes I've ever seen. And even when you know he's coming, there's not much you can do about it. So if good health prevails, they're going to be able to use that weapon regardless of how the defenses stack. And if they put in 8 and 9 men in the box, which I've seen before, a healthy Wilson with Percy Harvin out there in the flat is going to have a real weapon that they haven't showed up to this point. Now, there are skeptics who say, well, Harvin has always been injury prone and he's going to be, you know, you can't count on him to be healthy. Well, you know, that's a possibility, but you could say that just about it with everybody. So I think that is something that's going to be a late-season weapon for Seattle. And I also think that, you know, every NFL team, every good one, has some degree of vulnerability. We see a lot now. I mean, I think Kansas City's offense is pretty average, and we've seen Denver with problems, and my gosh, their head coach has a a heart problem that he has to have surgery for. And
good point.
Things happen. So people forecasting in November what's going to play out, it's pretty hard to do. I mean, you can count on Tom Brady to be good, but beyond that, I think everything else is kind of a crapshoot. And I think Seahawks are exposing themselves a little bit, and teams are learning how to beat them. But that produces a counter move on the Seahawks' part. And everything I've seen from Pete Carroll and his offensive coordinator, Daryl Bevel, suggests they can come up with something. The key for them, as always, is avoiding turnovers. So they tend to be a conservative offense. But if they have to, go casino on everybody, they are capable of doing it, and Wilson is capable of executing.
Art, one of the great things about being a writer that you are and us here hosting this show is that we can do what the Seahawks claim they don't, and that's look ahead. And if you look a few weeks ahead, how great is that week of football going to be, the first week of December when New Orleans comes to town for Monday night, and then just 6 days later, Seattle down at San Francisco, December 2 through December 8?
A lot of fun. A lot of fun. Seattle has got the best record in the NFL on Monday night games. I think they're 17-8, and that's the best percentage in the league. And so it's really kind of, it's for some reason this team and this city gets really amped for those games. And, by then, who knows, it could be raining, it could be snowing, it just adds to the drama. And, of course, the New Orleans Saints remember that in 2010 they had a very unpleasant experience up here when in the first round of the playoffs, when they were heavy favorites, Seahawks beat them 36-25, I believe. And that was the game in which Marshawn Lynch recorded his remarkable beast quake when he went 67 yards on a touchdown run that caused so much excitement that the game actually registered on Richter scales here in Seattle. So that's going to be fun. And then the rematch in San Francisco is going to be electric, because San Francisco was embarrassed here September 15th when they lost 29-3, also on national TV on the Sunday night game. And they are playing very, very well right now. So the rematch is going to be fun, especially because Pete Carroll and Jim Harbaugh truly cannot stand one another. And that just adds to the whole rivalry and the contempt factor. It's just a lot of fun.
Art Thiel of SportsPressNW.com. Follow them at SportsPressNW on Twitter. You can also listen to Art Fridays and Saturdays on KPLU in the Pacific Northwest. Art, thanks so much for your time tonight. We appreciate your insight, and we look forward to hopefully having you on down the road.
All right. Sounds good, guys. Had fun. See you.
Thanks, Art.
Art Thiel, longtime Seattle sports writer, now doing his own thing and looks like he's taking names and making things happen with Sports Press NW.
Yeah, you talk about a busy individual. And Art is known. One of the things that he's known for is he never met a metaphor he could not twist beyond recognition. And, I look forward to, from time to time to reading his articles and everything. And so great, great gentleman to have on the show. When we come back, we're going to talk more sports. Going to talk about the NFL, the NBA, some of the other things going on in the world of sports. You're listening to the best sports talk on the Double with the Double S Express.
Who likes the inconvenience of car repairs? Not only do car repairs take time and money from you, but can you even trust your repair shop? Nate, Dave, and the team at Platinum Automotive Services in Tri-Cities, Washington are honest and trustworthy, and they take great care of your vehicle. From the basic oil change to full engine rebuilds, they do it all. Like the Platinum Automotive Services Facebook page for a shot at a free oil change. Platinum Automotive Services, platinum service without the platinum price.
What's my image?
What's my image?
What's my image?
At Images Barbershop and Styles, you get the best cut, the best design, and the best styles in the Sacramento area. Plus the affordable price, along with the fun, family-friendly atmosphere, you'll walk away with a look of satisfaction and the feeling of a new you. Do you have your image?
We have ours!
Images Barbershop and Styles, located at 10040 Bruceville Road, Elk Grove, California, Suite 140. For appointments, call 916-271-0218. That's Images Barbershop and Styles.
Welcome back to On the Double with the Double S Express, Sean Wally and Sean Boyd.
Welcome back to On the Double with the Double S Express, Sean Wally alongside Sean Boyd. Big thank you to Art Teal joining us from SportsPressNW.com, Sports Press Northwest, long time Seattle sports columnist with insight on the Mariners and coming up through the years and the Seahawks currently, and some of Art's insights and writing for all those years at the Seattle PI.
Yeah, you know, I remember those times, you know, with Art writing for the Seattle PI, and, you know, as I was a young lad growing up in the Pacific Northwest, you know, I remember, you know, grabbing the newspaper, you know, just one of those weird kids that loved to grab the newspaper and go right to the sports section. And I remember seeing Art Teal in the Seattle PI and always had some interesting things to say, you know, things that weren't exactly the mainstream. You know, he always found a way to find an interesting topic that had to go with one of the great things that we loved. And so, you know, great sports writer, and it was a pleasure having him on the show.
So sticking with NFL for a few more moments here, what did the Jets do to the New Orleans Saints yesterday?
Yeah, you know, I just when you want to count the New York Jets out, you know, they find a way. You know, just like that old saying in the Godfather, just when I thought I was out, they keep pulling me back in. And the, you know, New York Jets fans, they've been going on this roller coaster ride for a while. And, you know, I thought that in the Ryan Bowl, that's what they were calling it, the Ryan Bowl, with Rex Ryan and Rob Ryan going at it. Of course, you know, Rex being the head coach and Rob Ryan the head coach of the Jets, and Rob Ryan being the defense coordinator of the New Orleans Saints. I really thought that, you know, this Sean Payton-led team, Drew Brees-led team, along with this great defense that's, you know, been coming back into fruition for the New Orleans Saints, was going to take care of business. And then they play the game, and, you know, Geno Smith, he didn't have a great game. I mean, it was 8-19 for 115 yards, didn't have a touchdown, no interceptions, but they were right there. There were those key turnovers that the Jets needed that came up, and, you know, the ball would bounce a certain way or off of the New Orleans Saints' hands and right into the Jets, and it set themselves – They set themselves up for taking advantage of the opportunities that were given to them.
And in the process, helped the Seattle Seahawks get a 1.5-game lead on the conference, and the Saints are tied with the 49ers.
And that's all that matters, isn't it, Sean Wally? For our Seattle fans, that's all that matters. I was wondering what this Jets significance was all about, you know? It's all about Seattle gaining a little bit of air to get home field.
Exactly.
Jeez.
Gotta breathe. Gotta have some breathing.
Oh,
room.
My goodness. Well, I mean,
no, it's still gonna come down to December 2nd in Seattle with the Saints, and then, you know, 6 days later in San Francisco, Seattle traveling down. Those two games right there should definitely be able to tell who may end up with home field advantage after that.
Yeah, you're talking about those two games, especially December 8th coming up in the, you know, that game in San Francisco. You know, things are starting to look like San Francisco is licking their wounds, or actually coming back from licking their wounds and having some healthy people coming back. It sounds like Justin Smith is back in camp, and there's a chance that he might suit up this weekend. I'm not sure. But obviously things are going well with his treatment. Mario Manningham is in camp. So, you know, the San Francisco 49ers have been looking for, you know, some help at the receiver position. And it sounds like, you know, Mario's back, and then a couple of weeks later, it sounds like Crabtree will be back. You know, I'm excited. I'm excited for the game coming up in December, and I believe that Seattle will be up for the challenge. I don't know if San Francisco is quite ready for the traveling that the Seattle fans, the 12th man, has for them. I mean, you know, we've seen the 12th man in Arizona. We've seen the 12th man in the Midwest. And San Francisco needs to look out, because there are quite a few people that I know from the Pacific Northwest that are going to be heading down, including yourself. And I sense that there's going to be a huge, huge representation of the 12th man in the stands.
Well, it's definitely nice to see at, you know, as you mentioned it, the Thursday night game in Arizona, when the post game guys on the set were like, this is incredible. You know, we've never seen this many visiting fans someplace. And, you know, that's, you know, counting games where they've, you know, obviously done games with the Steelers, the Raiders, and the teams that do travel really well and fans show up. And, you know, it's nice to see, because it hasn't always been that way for Seattle and the 12th man.
Yeah, it's something that's mind-boggling to me, because, you know, Seattle has had some success in the past 8 years, and of course having the Super Bowl appearance in 2005. One of the things that strikes me as odd, especially in this area, in the Bay Area, of course there's the San Francisco 49ers have a huge fan base out here. I see a lot of Seattle Seahawks paraphernalia in the Sacramento area. And, you know, without fail, I'll walk up and I'll say, hey, you know, are you from Seattle? Because I want to know. Why they're wearing this gear. And you know what, Sean? The interesting thing is they come back with an answer and they say, well, I'm a 49ers fan. I just like the colors. And, you know, that's the difference between a Seahawks fan and a 49ers fan. 49ers fans will just wear anything as long as it looks cool. And, you know, whoever the designer was for the Seahawks uniforms, of course, the Seahawks uniforms have evolved also in the past 10 years. Whoever came up with this design knew exactly what they were doing, because people just want to wear their stuff just because, you know, it's eccentric and it looks cool.
I have hated that growing up, and I still hate it to this day, to just wear something just because it looks nice. And, you know, especially a 49er fan, it's like, that's your number one rival. What are you doing?
Yeah, you know, and I feel the same way. You know, I don't know of any Oakland Raiders fans that would wear anything else but Oakland Raiders gear. But if you have your leader of the team, meaning in Colin Kaepernick, and Colin wears, you know, in the beginning of the season there, or in the offseason, there was this big deal. Remember, he was wearing the Miami Dolphins hat. And I think he was wearing the Miami Dolphins hat because of their eccentric colors, a lot like Seattle's. And it just looks cool. No big deal, right? But to the fanatic, the actual fan that you know, eats, sleeps, and breathes their team, it strikes me as odd. And, you know, there are a lot of 49er fans that seem to think that it's not a problem. And again, this is a team that's in the same division. So it baffles me, you know, but again, I believe that there's going to be lots of fans in San Francisco, Seahawks fans, the 12th man, and it'll sound almost as if it's a neutral site.
Well, we'll definitely have a lot more on that game coming up in the weeks ahead as we get closer to that big battle down at Candlestick. And it's going to be some fun times between now and then. And let's shift gears to the college ranks. And Sean, I don't know if you've noticed. I'm sure you've noticed. You're in tune with everything. November 9th, coming up this weekend, a huge game, LSU and Alabama.
Man, I... You know how I feel about Alabama, and there's no way in the world that I would root for Alabama in any way, shape, or form. The LSU Tigers going in to take care of business at Alabama, that's just, you know, that's what I'm looking forward to. Of course, my ties go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and, you know, that was one of the colleges that I were finalists for me, you know, in picking – to go to college. And, of course, I picked Auburn University. But, you know, I would love more than anything to see Alabama go down. And, you know, for one, to have Oregon get themselves back into the BCS. What is this all about, Sean Wally, as far as, you know, the Oregon Ducks? The new BCS poll comes out, and I know that Oregon had a bye this week, but so did Alabama. Alabama stays number one. Florida State beats Miami, and Florida State moves into the number two slot and bumps the Oregon Ducks down to three.
Yeah, you're not playing, and it hurts you. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it didn't hurt Alabama, you know, and so, you know, here you have this juxtaposed, if you will, you know, and Florida State, don't get me wrong, I believe that it would be a great game, national title game, if Florida State was in there in any way, shape, or form. But to jump a team, you know, to get to that spot, I'm wondering, you know, what that's all about.
East Coast bias.
I knew you were going to say that. I just had to throw that out there, you know, just to get our West Coast listeners all roused up and everything. But, yeah, again, you're right. That LSU, the LSU-Alabama game is going to be a great one. Now, here's another game that I'm looking forward to. Let's say that Alabama runs the table, you know, going to the last game of the season. Look who's jumped into the BCS standings here at number nine. And it is the old Auburn Tigers, War Eagle. They're in the BCS, and they're playing some great football. I'm hoping also, this is another scenario, that both of these teams come in with the records that they have, with Alabama with zero losses and Auburn with their one loss, of course, and Auburn just upends them and knocks them out of the BCS championship. You know, wouldn't that be great?
Hard to imagine that the Mike Leach-led Washington State Cougars played Auburn to a close contest.
Yeah, you know, I mean, here we talk about the strength of the SEC, and the Pac-12 is coming along. You know, they have, you know, we're talking about the LSU game, LSU-Alabama game this weekend. There's a huge game in the Pac-12 this weekend, and we can't look past that. You know, you have Oregon Ducks going in to face the Stanford Cardinal, who's number five in the land. And so that is probably one of the biggest games, if not the biggest game of the year to date. And so, you know, as far as, you know, top five teams going up against each other. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to that one this weekend.
A lot of great football all over the map. College, NFL, of course, you know, on a smaller scale, high school playoffs getting set to start. It is fall. It is football time. And as you're mentioning, Auburn doing well, and they, of course, as usual, will take on Alabama on November 29th to end their regular season, and thankfully for Auburn, that is in Auburn.
Yeah, Jordan Air Stadium is going to be rocking. You know, if there's a place that has deafening crowd noise, it is on the plains in Auburn, Alabama. And, you know, that is the mecca of football. I know that people say, you know, the Florida State-Miami game or you know, Florida against Miami or you know, Washington State for that matter, USC, UCLA, any of those rivals that you mentioned, to me, they pale in comparison to the Iron Bowl when Auburn and Alabama take the field, man. It should be a great, great game. I think that, of course, you know, I believe that Auburn's just going to kick the tar out of Alabama. And so, you know, and that's going to set up some great things for Auburn to play in one of the bigger bowls in the BCS.
Sean Boyd, what's your take on the, as a former coach yourself of many sports, but football included, what's your take on the amount of stress that these coaches in the NFL are under? Because as Art Thiel alluded to, you got John Fox with issues in Denver. We had Gary Kubiak in Houston go down last night on the field. And now they're saying that he had a mild stroke. Mm-hmm. And he's only 52. He looks to be in good shape. But, you know, he went down last night. And the stress that these guys are on and the hours they put in, it's just got to be way too many.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I wanted to talk on this topic. you know, with the amount of coaches that are going down, and of course there's the head coach at University of Minnesota that's been having battles of epileptic seizures over the past few weeks. You know, I have a strong deal of empathy for the coaches, because for one, as you'd mentioned, it could be any one of us who, and on the baseball side, Eric Wedge, the former manager of the Seattle Mariners as well, you know, any one of us could go through that. And it's not just the wear and tear on the actual coach. It's the wear and tear on that particular coach's family. You know, the whole nine. I think back on those times when I was so heavy into coaching. There's the coach's meeting, you know, that right after practice. And, you know, that could be in the classroom or the coaches can be off of campus and meet an area. Just the relentless hours that are put into it, to where you'll either wind up walking out of the school, or whether it's meeting at an eatery or at one of the coaches' houses, you wind up walking out sometimes 1-2 in the morning, and then you go home and prepare for the next day. That's a wear and tear on your body. That's a wear and tear, mentally on your family. And coaches, they do this day in and day out. And I can remember doing this. And I can remember going from football season into basketball season and into track season. And I could remember just feeling like, man, there's no time to be exhausted, because, you know, I had a great coach tell me when I first became a head coach at the high school level. One of the greatest coaches, one of the greatest mentors that I had, Jim Good. And, you know, Coach Good told me once I got that job, he said, you know what, coach? He says, there's one word of advice that I can give to you. And that advice is to never be outcoached. And when he told me that, you know, it was like a baton that was being passed. And I said, you know what, coach? I looked him dead in his eye, and I'm thinking, and I nodded my head, but the nod was, you know, I'm not going to let you down. And, you know, when you look at coaches like John Fox and Gary Kubiak, and, you know, you see the toll that it's taking on these coaches, it's just a matter of time. And, you know, and unfortunately, what these coaches have to do now is they have to take a step back and reevaluate some things on what they want to do with their life. Do they want to continue to push the envelope, and do they continue want to chase the brass ring as far as the championship is concerned? Or do they need to just scale it back and think of some other areas and start to spend more time with their families and just take a break from it all? That's a tough thing to do, Sean Wally. It's a very tough thing, because coaching is a drug. It's an addiction just like any other addiction. And I remember the time when I actually stepped away from coaching. And, you know, I had some time to spend with the family, and I'm at home. And, you know, I remember going to the refrigerator one time, and, you know, I'm reaching to open up the refrigerator, and I just started crying. And, you know, not even understanding what it was all about. You know, my wife's like, what's going on? What's wrong with you? And I just said, you know, I miss it. I miss the kids. I miss the grass. I miss the whistle being blown. I miss all of that stuff. And basically what I was going through is I was going through a detox, because my body was so used to going through those rigors. And that's the biggest fear as a coach, is what am I going to do after it's all done? And so, but, you know, more importantly, I'm wishing, you know, tremendous recovery for John Fox and Gary Kubiak and any other coach that has to go through, you know, the mental stresses of coaching, because it isn't an easy task to get the ball club going on all cylinders. And, you know, again, I'm just hoping that, you know, these coaches have a speedy recovery.
That's the voice of Sean Boyd. I am Sean Wally. This is On the Double with the Double S Express as we wrap up show 26. Hard to believe 26 shows just about in the books.
Man, we're moving right along. Moving right along, and we passed silver in a flash. And so this is some fun times, man. And, of course, having Art Teal on earlier and, you know, getting a chance to pick his brain a little bit and see, you know, how he's spinning the plates, if you will, on you know, reinventing himself. You know, the Seattle PI, he said, was around for 150 years. And all of a sudden, that paper decides, and the Hearst Corporation decides that, you know, it's no longer in Seattle. Hey, Sean, I have a question for you. Is that little ball still spinning down there off near Elliott Avenue?
Oh, goodness. Art could answer that much easier. I think it was purchased. Because, I mean, the PI is still out there online, but they got rid of the print and the actual newspaper, and they run things with servers now, like a lot of online ventures. But, yeah, I'd have to look into that, but I believe the PI Globe was purchased or bought to stay on the building, so it would, you know, stay the landmark that it always has been.
Yeah, you know, those are fun times. You know, definitely going into Seattle, and you know, that's one of the landmarks, as you were saying, the staples of Seattle is seeing that Seattle PI ball spinning around, and I just wonder if it's still in circulation.
Another week ahead, lots of great sports to get to between now and our next show, which will be show 27 next Monday night. And you can follow us on Twitter at @SSExpress, Express with no E, XPRESS, as well as look us up on Facebook. We have a SSExpress fan page. Stay in tune with our show and let us know what you think, good, bad, or indifferent. So that's going to wrap up show number 26. For Sean Boyd in Sacramento, California, I'm Sean Wally in Tri-Cities, Washington. This has been On the Double with the SSExpress.
Thanks for listening to On the Double with the SSExpress. Join us next Monday for some more great sports talk and big-time guests. On the Double with the SSExpress.